Southern California before a water famine developed. What made matters worse was that in order to deliver Northern California water to Los Angeles, you would have to contend with the Tehachapi Mountains, which separate Southern California from the San Joaquin Valley. Either you had to tunnel through that brutish barren summit, or you had to pump the water up and over, two-thirds of a vertical mile. Since the Tehachapi sit on two major active earthquake faults, the Garlock and the San Andreas, tunneling would be risky. An earthquake could crush the aqueduct inside the mountains and shut off the water for months or years. That meant you would have to pump the water uphill, and the energy requirements would simply be awesome. Why, then, would Los Angeles, which had most of its water arriving entirely by gravity from the Owens River, and the rest of the South Coast region, which got its water pumped by subsidized electricity from Hoover Dam, vote for a project that would sell them expensive water they wouldn't need for decades? There were two possible reasons. One was Arizona's lawsuit against California over its Colorado River entitlement. If California lost and the Central Arizona project was built, Southern California would have to forfeit a vast quantity of water, on whose promise much of its expected growth was based, water enough for 3 million people. With such stakes, its smug confidence that it would win the lawsuit had to be at least somewhat shaky. The other reason Southern California might go along was simply that opportunities to find water did not arise every year. 10 or 20 years would be required to complete the project. By the time it was finished, if the region continued its spellbinding growth, there would be millions of new people there. Los Angeles was growing so fast that it might not want to pass up any opportunity to find more water, whether it made good sense or not. If one thought about it this way, and thought about it long enough, it all began to seem inevitable. Los Angeles would resist, it would drag its feet and fret, but once the project began to roll through the legislature, it would climb aboard. Since Southern California was, financially speaking, the key to the whole plan, it simply had to be dragged along. Southern California would sign on, out of fear, out of simple ignorance, if nothing else. And Southern Californians would get some of the water, but not too much. During the winter of 1955, California was hit by the biggest flood since the monumental deluges of 1861 and 1862. After weeks of almost continuous rain, the rivers of the Sierra Nevada and the North Coast were tumultuous. The Eel River in the coastal mountains, which nearly dries up during the late summer and fall, was carrying the flow of the Yukon, the St. Lawrence, and the Missouri combined. The flood that spilled out of the mouth of the Eel, 550,000 cubic feet per second, could have driven a fleet of battleships to Japan. The Sacramento River, despite the enormous bulk of Shasta Dam in its path, also rose to monstrous heights. But it was the Feather River, the Sacramento's main tributary in the northern Sierra, that was the killer. At the end of December, as a series of huge, slow-moving cloud masses wrung themselves out against the western wall of the range, the Feather River rose with hurricane suddenness. Swelling toward a crest of 250,000 cubic feet per second, it burst out of its canyon and flooded over Yuba City and Marysville, two small cities on the floodplain below, near the confluence with the Sacramento. Within hours, a parade of houses, some wrecked and some nearly intact, was floating toward San Francisco. Yuba City was substantially destroyed, first by water and then by mud. More than 20 people died. The San Joaquin growers would never have admitted to feeling relief, but the Marysville and Yuba City disaster was the best news they had heard in years. If there had to be floods, the Feather River's wrath was a serendipitous one, for it had already been chosen as their river of rescue. The origins of the rescue project went back to the Bureau of Reclamation's United Western Investigation, the two-year study of transcontinental water diversion schemes completed in 1951 that had been the swan song of Commissioner Mike Strauss. Having looked at the possibility of diverting the Columbia, the Snake, and all the larger rivers of the Northwest to the desert Southwest, the Bureau had settled on the Klamath, which it wanted to run in reverse through a 60-mile tunnel back into the Sacramento River and then south. The plan had collapsed under the weight of its own ambition, and the Eisenhower administration had administered the coup de grace by firing Strauss. But the idea of a trans-basin water diversion had quickened the pulse of California state engineer A.D. Edmonston, an unreconstructed, gung-ho New Deal water development type. In 1951, Edmonston, backed by the agricultural lobby, persuaded the legislature to give him enough money to undertake an inventory of the state's water resources, where water was in surplus, where it might be needed. What emerged 3 years later was something else entirely. The inventory had metamorphosed into something called the California Water Plan, a scheme for moving water southward that virtually duplicated the Bureau's plan. Only two things were different. There would be no Martian aqueduct leading from the Klamath River to Lake Mead. The remote Klamath was, in fact, out of the picture, replaced by the smaller but much more accessible Feather River. The other distinction was that the plan, as envisioned by Edmonston, would not be a federal project in any sense. It did not come right out and say so, perhaps because it hoped to get some federal help, but if one read between the lines, the state, or at least Edmonston, was now contemplating something this monumental on its own, just as it had originally planned the CVP. In fact, no sooner was the California Water Plan released than a new agency, the Department of Water Resources, was created out of a jumble of 52 agencies that had previously dealt with water and given administrative powers to match. Edmonston's scheme was mesmerizing. The largest water project ever built by a state or local government was New York City's Delaware Water System, completed during World War II. The Delaware Aqueduct was 85 miles long and entirely underground, by far the longest hard rock tunnel in the world. But the California Water Plan, in its first phase alone, contemplated the movement of four times more water over a distance six times as long. What was even more startling was that most of the water would go to irrigation. The Delaware Aqueduct had left New York, a Babylon of wealth, up to its ears in debt. But since each average household paid around $100 an acre-foot for water, and because the city had a huge commercial and industrial sector sharing the cost, the bonds would be paid off unless the city, for some reason, saw its growth curve go drastically into reverse. In the mid-1950s, the most that irrigation farmers could pay for water was, by a generous average, about $15 an acre-foot, less than a fifth as much as New Yorkers paid. And New York City's water arrived by gravity. California's farmers would have to pay for several hundred vertical feet of pumping, and Los Angeles would have to buy water pumped more than 3,000 feet if the aqueduct went over instead of through the Tehachapi Mountains. The United Western investigation had already concluded that tunneling was too risky because of earthquake hazards. How could anyone afford it? What passed for an answer provides an insight into the thinking of Edmonston and the water lobby and a good many politicians at the time. It was also as remarkable a statement as any certifiably sane person ever made. It is believed that the cost of water will not be a limiting factor in ultimate development of the water resources of California, Edmonston's report read. It is indicated that urban communities will always be able and willing to pay the cost of water to meet their municipal needs. Furthermore, it is considered probable that under pressure of future demands for agricultural produce, the water necessary for greatly expanded irrigation development will be provided at whatever cost may be required. Many works, financially infeasible today, will undoubtedly be financed and constructed in the future. If anyone found such a statement preposterous, it was really like saying that because of population pressure we were bound to settle Mars, he kept his opinions to himself. The nearest thing to a publicly expressed doubt was the somewhat timorous suggestion of the Stanford Research Institute, which was asked to comment on the report, that a definite price policy would be required for more realistic estimates of probable water sales, and that these, in turn, might well decide the financial outcome of the project. that is, whether or not it would end in the greatest bankruptcy of all time. The prevalent mood was more accurately reflected in a remark by the director of California's new Department of Water Resources, Harvey Banks, a remark he used in a great many of the speeches he gave to drum up support for the plan. "We must build now," Banks would say, "and ask questions later." Meanwhile, the financial foundation of this most recklessly ambitious of plans was quietly being laid. In the 1940s, some petroleum deposits were discovered off the Southern California coast, near Long Beach. A few years later, when several major oil companies announced that they planned to begin exploiting the reserve, California decided to impose a severance or extraction tax and agreed to give the revenues to Long Beach. After all, the money wouldn't amount to all that much, and Long Beach would need it to enlarge its harbor and cope with a mini-boom that would inevitably result. But after the Tidelands oil revenues had been promised to Long Beach, in a contract duly signed by the city and state, the amount of oil offshore was discovered to be far greater than the initial estimates had indicated. The severance tax, if these estimates were correct, would amount to hundreds of millions of dollars over the years. As a result, the Attorney General of California decided that there was only one sensible course of action. He nullified the contract. The Attorney General, whose name was Edmund G. Brown, was at the time a politician of less than starlit promise. Of middle height, a little squat, Pat Brown was a cheery Irish ward-heeler kind of politician, hale, earthy, utterly lacking in the complexity and awkwardness of his future rival, Richard Nixon. At about the same time he voided Long Beach's Tidelands oil contract, Pat Brown developed an obsession, one that would remain with him for the rest of his life. Water. As his water czar, Bill Warren, was to describe it later on, Bob Edmonston, the state engineer, had corralled him one day in the Capitol and implored him to do something about the water crisis. Brown, who grew up in San Francisco, said he wasn't aware there was any. Hadn't Los Angeles built its Colorado River aqueduct? Hadn't the Bureau just built the Central Valley Project? Yes, answered Edmonston, and that was precisely the problem. When you added a couple of lanes to a freeway or built a new bridge, cars came out of nowhere to fill them. It was the same with water. The more you developed, the more growth occurred, and the faster demand grew. California was now hitched to a runaway locomotive. At the rate the state was growing in both population and irrigated agriculture, it ought to be developing 750,000 new acre-feet each year. It was developing nothing. It had no major plans. Even if it started today, it would take 20 years to get a big project authorized, financed, and built. By then, California could have another 7 or 8 million people. When we finally come to our senses, Edmonston told Brown, the biggest bandwagon in history is going to come rolling through with water written all over it. If you want to be elected governor, you jump on it early, now. It was a moment of epiphany, Brown told his friends. The thought of all those people arriving to no water, perhaps even to a biblical drought, suddenly left him staggered. He would never be the same. Edmonston was right. Water was worth developing at whatever cost. Nearly 25 years later, in 1979, he still believed it. In an interview he granted to the University of California's Oral History Program, Brown said, "No, I don't think its cost has any validity because you need water. Whatever it costs, you have to pay it. It's like oil today. If you have to have oil, you've got to pay for it. What's the value of oil? What's the value of water? If you're crossing the desert and you haven't got a bottle of water and there's no water anyplace in sight and someone comes along and says, 'I'll sell you 2 spoonfuls of water for $10, you'll pay for it. The same is true in California. In 1958, after campaigning for and winning the governorship of the state, Pat Brown turned to the task of building his new dream, Edmonston's water plan, with an energy few of his friends had ever seen. He wheedled, cajoled, and mule-traded like a homegrown Lyndon Johnson, trying to accomplish something which, in its own way, was as daunting as Johnson's Great Society agenda, uniting a state divided into wet and dry parts, into sophisticated cities and hundreds of mean little farm towns on a breathtaking agenda of water development. An Irish Catholic, Brown came across like a missionary preaching to the damned when he spoke to Californians of their water crisis. But he was also ruled, at times, by a Catholic's impulse to confess, and later he would tell an interviewer about his other, more prosaic motivation. "I loved building things," he blurted in an unguarded moment of candor. "I wanted to build that goddamn water project. I was absolutely determined I was going to pass this California water project. I wanted this to be a monument to me." It must have been frustrating for Brown that the most implacable opposition did not at first come from Northern California, as expected. It came from the corner of the state whose cooperation was essential if the project was ever to be built, Metropolitan Los Angeles. The stubborn resistance of the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California to a plan that would give it more water at one stroke than it had ever received was perfectly understandable from its point of view, even if it was baffling on its face. The water it had been counting on to meet its future growth was water that Arizona felt it rightfully owned and was at issue in a seemingly endless lawsuit then before the Supreme Court. The Met's case, which was based largely on Arizona's initial refusal to sign the Colorado River Compact, was somewhat flimsy. It wasn't so much a legal argument as a game of chicken with the Supreme Court. In effect, the Met was daring the court to take away water for 3 million people just as they were coming to depend on it. Because of the weakness of its legal position, Southern California had at least as great a stake in thwarting bills that would have authorized a Central Arizona project, something which its congressional delegation had accomplished for 20 years. But the key to victory, in Congress if not in the Supreme Court, too, was demonstrating that the contested water was crucial to its growth, if not its very survival. From the Met's point of view, then, the Feather River Project, which it ought to have viewed as salvation, was in a more immediate sense a threat. If it was built, it could wash away the strategic foundation of its legal and moral argument. It was an absurd position to be in, but the Met was committed. It had to pretend that no water was available from anywhere else. As a result, the chairman of the Met's board of directors, Joe Jensen, decided to oppose the Feather River Project at all costs. The Met also disliked the idea of subsidizing the growers in the southern San Joaquin, who would receive half of the water but pay less than a third of the cost, and that was the argument it trundled out for public consumption. "If an urban area is to help carry this agricultural load," Warren Butler, the Met's vice chairman, told the Los Angeles Times on August 10, 1960, "the urban area of Kern County should." As Butler well knew, that urban area, Bakersfield, couldn't possibly afford to. If any project bringing water to the South Coast was going to be built, the Metropolitan Water District was going to build it on its own. While Pat Brown thumped his Feather River project up and down the state, Joe Jensen was talking about water from the Eel River, from the Trinity, from the Columbia, in due time, which was to say, after it had won its lawsuit with Arizona. While Brown talked of water famine in apocalyptic tones, the Met Board issued a statement that these forecasts of disaster are without foundation in fact. To the utter consternation of the growers, who were frantically lobbying for the project under the auspices of the Feather River Project Association, the Met went after the idea hammer and tongs, arguing against it on every conceivable ground: cost, need, feasibility, practicality, even morality. In 1957, the board of directors staged an opulent victory dinner in honor of several legislators who had successfully crushed the project's hopes in the last legislative session. "They refused to listen to reason," Bill Warren, Brown's water chief, would recall. "I must have gone down to talk to them a dozen times, but all they could think about was that they might weaken their case before the Supreme Court. I didn't think they would. As a matter of fact, I didn't think they had much of a case to begin with, but they thought they did." Pat Brown was wise enough to see that eventually the Met would be brought into the fold. "I remember Norman Chandler saying he was going to oppose the project in the Los Angeles Times, unless we went along with the Metropolitan's viewpoint, Brown recalled later in an interview. I told Norman, "Then you just oppose the project, Mr. Chandler. The people will look at you with scorn as the years go on." So he walked out, and I didn't know whether he was going to support it or not, but they had to do it. I knew we had them. I knew that if they didn't get this bond issue over, they'd never get water in Southern California. Actually, though, the Mets' opposition wasn't Pat Brown's thorniest problem, even if it may have been his most frustrating one. The thorniest problem was the cost. Brown knew that a lot of voters will vote reflexively against any bond issue, even want to hire police and build jails in the midst of a crime wave. They would rather not pay taxes and buy guns, rather not pay taxes and dig wells. This was especially true in Southern California, the home turf of the John Birch Society and the Liberty Lobby. Northern Californians were sure to be violently opposed, even if they were promised some of the water. Northern Californians had always resisted sending their water to L.A. Between metropolitan San Francisco, Sacramento, San Jose, Oakland, Stockton, and Contra Costa County, there were 4 million people, and at least 1 million voters, out of 3 million who might vote statewide, who were certain to go against him. Those votes had to be counterbalanced by yes votes in Southern California. But when those good Republican migrants from the Middle West down there saw how much the project would cost, they would blanch. How could he possibly win? There was only one way, Brown decided. It was to lie. Lie is a strong word, but in this case it is advised because one day Pat Brown would all but admit it himself. It was, to begin with, hard to say how much the project would cost, except that it would cost a bundle. Oroville would be not only the world's tallest dam, but its fourth most massive. San Luis, in the Coast Range foothills farther south, would be the fifth most massive dam in the world, nearly 2 miles long. Two of the world's biggest dams, the world's longest aqueduct, the world's highest pump lift, surmounted by the world's most powerful pumps, 5 full batteries of pumps, a chain of smaller dams and reservoirs strung out to receive the water, all of this would be incredibly expensive. The Department of Water Resources feasibility report, known as Bulletin 78, offered an estimate of $1,807,000,000, but an economist for the Rand Corporation, Jack Hirschleifer, immediately tore it to shreds. Reading between the lines, Hirschleifer noticed that though the report mentioned Oroville Dam at length, it failed to include the expense of building it. It was an extraordinary omission, to say the least. The DWR explained that the dam wouldn't be needed right away and might be built later. It would be built right away. The estimate also failed to include the cost of branch aqueducts to San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara, although the DWR had promised those cities water, and Pat Brown was counting on their votes. And there was no cross-delta facility, later known as the Peripheral Canal, on the price list, though without it the project could never deliver its full annual yield of 4,230,000 acre-feet. In fact, it was unclear how the above-mentioned facilities, immense as they were, and assuming all were built, could deliver that much water every year. Even ignoring that, Hirschleifer wrote in his report, the correct figure, for capital costs only, and accepting official estimates, is certainly in excess of $3 billion. $3 billion in 1959 was the equivalent of $13 billion in 1987. What state would vote for a $13 billion bond issue today? Not one. Pat Brown knew that very well. That was why he decided to say that the project would cost $1.75 billion, just over half of what he knew, or should have known, the estimate should have been. Years later, a conversation with an unthreatening interviewer from Berkeley's oral history program finally brought out the truth. We were questioning, could we even pass a bond act of $1.75 billion, Brown told his interviewer, Malker Kahl. We didn't know exactly the cost of the project. We hadn't priced it out to any exactitude. As a matter of fact, we thought it would cost more than $1.75 billion, probably in the neighborhood of $2.5 billion. We had to scrape and pull to put this project together. I mean, don't kid yourself. It was a close fit, and $1.75 billion was about all that we felt we could get a bond issue. We were afraid to make it $2 billion. It was like $1.99 instead of $2. We thought that just sounded better to the people. I remember someone telling me how Huey Long operated in Louisiana, where the legislature wouldn't give him money to build the road, Brown added. He started at one end, built it to here, and left a great big gap. $1.99 instead of $2. Like many of the New Deal politicians of his era, Brown had a habit of dropping the last few zeros from his figures. These were billions, not pennies, that were being talked about, back when a billion was still real money. Brown's $750 million lie, and if Hirschleifer was right, it was considerably more than that, was a $3 billion lie in modern money. And it would set the stage for a monumental predicament, one that the governor's son, ironically, would be the first to have to face. In order to embark on building the project, the DWR would have to have contracts in hand to sell water. That was the whole idea, demand before supply. Those contracts would ultimately demand that the state deliver 4,230,000 acre-feet of water. But if the initial bond issue failed to deliver the full amount, and the voters subsequently rejected bonds to expand the project, the state would expose itself to a torrent of crippling lawsuits from cities and farmers who had planned their growth and invested their money on the promise of water it could never deliver. The damage claims might cost more than the project itself. Back in 1959, however, all of that still seemed far in the future. One of the reasons Pat Brown felt confident with his misleading cost estimate had to do with a Tidelands oil contract between Long Beach and the state, which as Attorney General he had abrogated in 1954. Long Beach was understandably outraged and immediately filed suit against the Attorney General's office. To its amazement, the California Supreme Court sided with the state. It was a remarkable legal opinion. The Attorney General had nullified a signed contract to let a city have some revenues, and the court had upheld him, even though the state had no demonstrable need for the revenues. It didn't even have a plan to use them. What kind of court was this? An answer, a speculative one, popped up in another part of the governor's long 1981 interview with Malka Call. Actually, they were discussing something else, Brown's decision to try to use the old Central Valley project bonds, which the voters had authorized in 1933, to scrape together another $170 million in cash. That, in its own right, was a matter of peculiar legality. Using a bond issue passed 27 years earlier, a bond issue that was meant to finance the Central Valley project in order to construct an entirely different water project. But, mystifyingly, the California Supreme Court had okayed that, too. That was Phil Gibson, the Chief Justice, with whom I worked very closely, Brown told his interviewer. Then, according to the transcript, he laughed. He was a great Chief Justice, and it was great to validate those bonds. The Chief Justice worked very, very closely with me in all of those decisions. You see, the Supreme Court didn't have to take original jurisdiction in those cases, but I would call the Chief Justice and say, Chief, this is very important. I want you to take it. And invariably he did. Phil Gibson died before he could be interviewed for this book, and Pat Brown, in a personal interview, hotly denied ever having tried to influence the court's decisions. But Gibson's obituary in the San Francisco Chronicle described him as perhaps the most powerful and influential Chief Justice in the history of the court, and he was, after all, Pat Brown's bosom friend. All of this leaves at least a suggestion that in California, where an issue as important as water was concerned, strict legality, separation of powers, honesty, and other niceties of governmental conduct could easily be ground into mush. In 1959, after intensive lobbying by Pat Brown, the California state legislature agreed to allot the Tidelands oil money for the water project, an annual interest-free loan of $25 million, repayable whenever. It was an open-ended deal. The Tidelands Oil Fund could keep feeding the project until the oil ran out, which might take 100 years. Even Brown would admit in yet another startling little confession to Malka Call that it was another subsidy to the big farmers. But it was not just any old subsidy. It was a subsidy that had an architectural elegance, a wonderful symmetry to it. Several of the big farmers who would get much of the water from the Feather River project were oil companies, the same oil companies that were paying into the Tidelands Oil Fund, in exchange for a modest extraction tax, quickly offset by the billions they would make on the easily accessible oil. They would have their barren, worthless acreages in the San Joaquin Valley turned opalescent green. And they would get the growth and the cars and the freeways that would increase the demand for and the cost of the oil. In the last days of the legislative session in 1959, the legislature gave final approval to the Burns-Porter Act, which authorized the Feather River Project, now rechristened the California Water Project, subject to a statewide referendum on the bond issue scheduled for November of the following year. Once again, Pat Brown had shown what great Irish politicians' instincts he possessed. One of the two sponsors, Hugh Burns, was a Northern Californian who had made a reputation opposing water diversions from the North. Brown, among whose attributes modesty was notably absent, would later boast, "The fact that I selected Hugh Burns to carry the bill in the Senate, that was political genius, if I do say so myself." Cyril Magnin, Mr. San Francisco, was persuaded to serve as campaign chairman there. The supporters put on prominent display in Southern California were fiscal conservatives and Republicans. Everyone would get a little water, too. Napa County, Alameda County, the Santa Clara Valley. But the Kern County Water Agency alone would get 30 times as much as all of California north of San Francisco. Only in December, after the legislature had already authorized the project, did the Department of Water Resources make a stab at an economic justification. In a report called An Investigation of Alternative Aqueduct Systems to Serve Southern California. Instead of trying to justify the project by weighing costs against benefits, which is what the Bureau of Reclamation did or went through the motions of doing, it compared the cost of the project to the most expensive alternative, desalinating seawater. On that basis, it concluded that the project made sense. But as Jack Hirschleifer disdainfully commented in his RAND Corporation report, you can justify anything if you compare it to a more expensive alternative. The critics were too few and too late. On Friday, November 4th, 1960, just 4 days before the referendum was scheduled, the Metropolitan Water District capitulated and signed the contracts that indicated its support. The Los Angeles Times was now in favor. The only widely read newspaper that adamantly opposed the plan was the San Francisco Chronicle. When the votes finally came in, 48 of the 58 counties in the state had voted against the bonds, but the populous counties in the artificial paradise of Southern California all went heavily for the project. It was, after all, early November, and they hadn't seen real rain since April. November, the last days before the rainy season began. That was another little bit of subtlety from Pat Brown. The bond issue passed by 174,000 votes. The California Aqueduct begins at Oroville Dam, an inverted pyramid of such improbable dimensions, the height of the Pan Am Building, the length of the Golden Gate Bridge, that it appears much smaller than it actually is. In February of 1980, in the midst of a long spell of wet Pacific fronts, Oroville Reservoir, despite its capacity of something like a trillion gallons, was full, and the dam was spilling, 70,000 cubic feet per second, the Hudson River in full flood, roaring down the spillway at 40 miles per hour, sending a plume of mist 1,000 feet in the air. Below the dam and the Thermalito afterbay, the Feather River joins the Sacramento, which flows through the delta out to San Francisco Bay. In the winter of 1980, the delta, a huge reclaimed marsh protected by weakening dikes made of peat, was in danger of being reclaimed by nature. The levees were being repeatedly breached by the flood, and farmed tracts of 3,000 acres were disappearing under 20 feet of water. From a chartered Piper Cub, the odd vulnerability of this Brobdingnagian contrivance was manifest. The levees keep intruding seawater from mingling with Southern California's water as it traverses the delta on its way to the California Aqueduct, which begins south of there. The delta is the system's weakest link, and what could see why from an airplane. Below was the water on which 1 million-plus acres and 10 million people depend. A few miles west, lapping hungrily at the first phalanx of levees, was the tongue of a salty ocean that humbles all. At the south end of the delta, the Clifton Court Forebay appeared below us, a receiving reservoir big as a Minnesota lake that rises and falls like the Bay of Fundy in rhythm with Southern California's thirst. A wide canal leads out of the forebay toward a rectangular building resembling the non-nuclear end of a very large nuclear power plant. The building houses the Delta Pumps, a battery of 10,000 horsepower machines that suck Feather River water 30 miles across the Delta before it can escape to sea, then lift it the first 300 feet toward its ultimate 3,400-foot rise over the Tehachapi Mountains. The water disappears inside and reappears 30 stories up the hill at the beginning of the California Aqueduct. From overhead, one could see the water spurting out of the siphons, each one wide enough to consume a freight car, as if shot from a water cannon. The aqueduct wound southward through the pale foothills, as level as a railroad grade, and disappeared in valley heat. It is 444 miles long, the longest river, if you can call it that, in California, and it is entirely man-made. Interstate 5 parallels the aqueduct for 250 miles through the San Joaquin Valley. Not many years ago, this was utterly barren land. It sprouted some patches of green during the winter, then lay dead during summer's drought. Now it is a wide swath of cotton and orchards growing billions of new dollars in agricultural wealth. 100 miles south of the Clifton Court Forebay, the water arrives at San Luis Dam, now the ninth largest dam in the world, a structure almost as immense as Oroville. What is bizarre about San Luis is that its basin, in the rain shadow of the Coast Range, is devoid of constant streams. Nearly all the water in the huge reservoir, 8 miles across, is Feather River and Sacramento River water, pumped uphill. San Luis adds stability and security in a state inclined toward unpredictable weather and tectonic upheaval. In such a theater of disaster, a state utterly dependent on reservoirs needs to store its water in as many places as possible. The penalty for this added security is the giant jolt of electricity required to lift the water another 300 feet. It is a Sisyphean lift, for the water comes right back down again when the San Joaquin Valley and Los Angeles call for more. You recapture some of the expended energy in turbines when you release it from San Luis, but the overall loss is around 33%. More than any place else, California seems determined to prove that the second law of thermodynamics is a lie. This whole hydrologic ballet, this acrobatic rise and fall of megatonnages of water performed on a stage twice the length of Pennsylvania, is orchestrated by a silent choreographer in the Water Resources Building in Sacramento, a UNIVAC Series 904 computer punched and fed floppy disks by a team of programmers. At the south end of the valley, the aqueduct arrives at its moment of truth. The Sierra Escarpment curves westward and the Coast Range bends eastward, and they mate, producing a bastard offspring called the Transverse or Tehachapi Range. The Tehachapi stand between the water and Los Angeles, which sits in the ultramontane basin beyond. The water is carried across the Tehachapis in five separate stages, the final Cyclopean one, which occurs at the A.D. Edmonston pumping plant, raises the water 1,926 feet, the Eiffel Tower atop the Empire State, in a single lift. To some engineers, the Edmonston pumps are the ultimate triumph, the most splendid snub nature has ever received, a sizable river of water running uphill. At their peak capacity, if it is ever reached, the Edmundston pumps will require 6 billion kilowatt-hours of electricity every year, the output of an 1,100-megawatt power plant. Moving water in California requires more electrical energy than is used by several states. Having surmounted the Tehachapis, the water charges downhill again through closed siphons and a battery of turbines that steal some of its energy back. Soon it is in an open aqueduct again, which ultimately forks like an interstate highway. The West Branch goes straight to Los Angeles, and the East Branch continues southward across the high Mojave Desert to the vicinity of Riverside, where it terminates in Lake Paris, a reservoir. Lake Paris is 600 miles from Oroville Dam. Walking along the East Branch Aqueduct, you see people strolling, bicycling, and fishing, as if this were a river through a city park, instead of a concrete highway of water under a blazing sun in a shadeless desert where it rains 7 or 8 times a year. The Department of Water Resources stocks the aqueduct with fish. That way, it can write off a fraction of the project's cost to recreation. But fish seem to find their way in there anyway. In fact, sections of the aqueduct have respectable fishing for striped bass, which cannot easily tolerate the pollution of Chesapeake Bay or spawn in the freakish cross-delta currents that the project pumps have caused, but which don't seem to mind a 300-foot lift in a pressurized elevator of water. This turbid, computer-controlled, concrete-walled river is the unlikeliest habitat imaginable for striped bass, as fitting a symbol of wild, fecund nature as one could find. The water project seems as make-believe as California itself in its relentless quest to deny its desert heart. Aside from lying about the true cost of the state water project, Pat Brown and his water resources chief, Bill Warren, had been less than candid about another matter of supreme importance: how much water the initial bonds would actually buy. Most Californians, it seems, believed they were buying 4 million acre-feet or more. But as early as October of 1960, Joe Jensen had predicted that the bonds would never suffice to develop that much, and he was right. The initial facilities, it turned out, could deliver around 2.5 million acre-feet, perhaps 3 to 3 1/3 million in wetter years, at least 1 million acre-feet less than the various cities and irrigation districts had signed up to buy. Meanwhile, population projections for Southern California continued their horrifying march. In 1961, the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power was estimating that 40 million people would live in the South Coast area by 1990. By February of 1962, Alfred Goltz, Bill Warren's chief engineer, was already calling for new reservoir construction on the North Coast as early as 1972. Warren himself said that new reservoirs, dams, tunnels, and diversion projects must be undertaken somewhere in the North Coast area within the next 20 years. As it turned out, a splendid opportunity to do just that arrived sooner than Warren dared hope. In December of 1964, California was hit by floods that were even wilder than the great floods of 1955. In 3 days, from December 21st to 24th, Blue Canyon on the American River recorded 20 inches of rain. All the rivers were roaring, from Big Sur to the Oregon border and beyond. But the river that rampaged most was the Eel. The Eel rose 72 feet from its bed. It snapped bridges with surgical precision. It uprooted 300-foot redwoods. It swept 50 million board feet of timber out to sea, driftwood which, for the most part, is still piled along California's beaches. At Scotia, near its mouth, the Eel was carrying the Mississippi River in a garment bag. 765,000 cubic feet of water were going by each second. Every town along the river was damaged. Some were never seen again. The high water mark can still be seen along the Avenue of the Giants, displayed on a number of redwood trees. It is about 3 stories above the road. The Christmas flood, the second 100-year flood in just 9 years, had Brown, Warren, and the Army Corps of Engineers issuing statements expressing profound dismay while they privately rubbed their hands with glee. Within months, the Corps, the Bureau, and the Department of Water Resources had locked arms as a state-federal interagency task force, ready, once and for all, to choke California's untamed rivers into submission. Every river on the North Coast, except the Smith and the Klamath, was to get at least one big dam. The various forks of the Eel were to get eight. But the Bureau and the Corps kept getting into scraps over who was to build what first, and Pat Brown's term was running out, so one by one, the dams fell into obscurity. By 1966, when Ronald Reagan became governor, the only dam in which strong interest was still being expressed was the largest, Dos Rios, on the middle fork of the Eel. With twice the storage capacity of Shasta Lake, Dos Rios was the ideal addition to the state water project. It could deliver another 900,000 acre-feet, almost enough to bring the total yield, in normal years, up to the 4,230,000 acre-feet the state had promised to deliver. The site was reasonably close to the Central Valley. All one had to do was dig a 21-mile tunnel through the Yalabali Mountains and dump the water into Stony Creek, a tributary of the Sacramento. Dos Rios had three things going against it, though the Eel had acquired such a black reputation that none seemed likely to prevent its being built. One was the fact that it would do nothing to control the Eel. During the Christmas flood, more than 500,000 cubic feet per second had poured out of the South and North Forks and the main Eel, which would all remain undammed. What did it matter if one's house was under 12 feet of water or 11 feet 4 inches? Those 8 inches at Scotia were the sum total of the flood crest that Dos Rios would contain. A local rancher, Richard Wilson, who had a degree in agricultural engineering from Dartmouth, proved it, and the Corps could only wish him wrong. Another drawback was that the reservoir would drown an Indian reservation in the town of Covelo, population 2,000, but that sort of thing had been done many times before. The Corps had included the flooding of the reservation in its benefit-cost analysis, but had it down as a benefit because the Indians would get a nicer town somewhere else. The third drawback was that the new governor of California, Ronald Reagan, wasn't particularly interested. Reagan, as a Westerner, should have been a friend of dams, but he was growing more conservative by the hour, and true conservatives tend to dislike great public works. He also distrusted the Corps of Engineers, a feeling which the Corps, if anything, seemed to reinforce. Reagan's resources secretary, Norman Livermore, remembers asking the Corps to do two cost-benefit analyses, one using the 3.25% interest rate which the Corps planned to use, the other using the 6.25% rate that reflected economic reality. "When they gave it to me," remembers Livermore, "I looked at the two columns, and the bottom line was exactly the same. I took it into a cabinet meeting and really got a laugh." For 4.5 years, Reagan stalled on Dos Rios while the water lobby was practically battering down his door. The head of his Department of Water Resources, Bill Gianelli, a short, square man with a Vince Lombardi temperament and an American flag perpetually stuck in his lapel, was, according to Richard Wilson, who was the leader of the ragtag opposition, an absolute zealot in favor of building the dam. So was Don Clawson, the Republican congressman representing the North Coast. But Wilson was a friend of Norman Livermore's, and Livermore had Reagan's ear. According to Wilson, when the governor realized he finally had to say yes or no, he asked Livermore to give him every argument he could think of against the dam. When Livermore was finished, he emerged from Reagan's office and almost fell into the arms of Don Clawson, who was waiting to give Reagan his arguments for the dam. Clawson was a voluble and persuasive man, but later he confided to his intimates what had really happened during the meeting. "Halfway through it," Clawson said dispiritedly, "the governor had fallen asleep." Wilson insists he got the story from Livermore himself, though Livermore, still a Reagan loyalist in 1984, said he couldn't remember it. Whatever the case, in 1969, Reagan finally announced that he would not support Dos Rios Dam. In the press release explaining his reasoning, he talked about costs, poor economics, the frailty of the flood control rationale. Privately, though, Reagan was upset about flooding the Round Valley Reservation. "We've broken enough treaties with the Indians already," the old cowboy actor is reported to have said. By the time Reagan left Sacramento in 1974, the Department of Water Resources was predicting that the dreaded shortfall, demand for water greater than supply of water, might be as little as 15 years away. To plan the final phase of the state water project, get it approved and funded, and build it would easily require 15 years. Through an irony some found delicious then, the person who took it upon himself to complete the project that Pat Brown had left unfinished was none other than the apostle of the era of limits, the first politician to proclaim that small is beautiful and less is more, Jerry Brown, Pat Brown's son. "He did it for the old man," was how Jerry Brown's last loyalists explained the spectacle of the younger Brown promoting what seems certain to become the most expensive broader project in the history of the world. Depending on which of the Brown administration's estimates one believed, and a new one seemed to appear every 6 months or so, the cost of completing the project was either astonishing or flabbergasting. What Pat Brown hadn't foreseen, when he underfunded the bond issue to ensure that the voters would pass it, was inflation. Because of inflation, it would cost 2 to 5 times more to deliver the project's last 1,730,000 acre-feet than it had cost to deliver the first 2.5 million. The most detailed estimate, released by the DWR in 1980, pegged the cost at $11.6 billion. Interest on the bonds, based on a rate of 9%, which was then 3 points too low, would add another $12 billion. It was unheard of. The only comparable schemes anywhere in the world were Canada's James Bay project and Itaipu Dam, which would end up costing $19 billion and help Brazil dig itself a bottomless financial hole. But Itaipu would at least generate 12,500 megawatts of electricity to help pay for itself. Brown's Phase 2 water plan would consume an awesome amount of power because the water, cubic miles of it, would be pumped not just uphill, but over a mountain range. Jerry Brown's dilemma, which was insoluble but which he thought he could solve anyway, was trying to please the water lobby and his large environmental constituency at the same time. He wanted a project, but he wanted it to be environmentally sound. There could be no on-stream storage, no dams or reservoirs on any significant wild streams. The North Coast rivers, with 29% of the state's runoff, were therefore off-limits. Instead, Brown wanted to skim high surplus flows from the Sacramento River during the winter and spring and store them. But all the natural storage basins were at elevations well above the river. His Department of Water Resources engineers, acting on orders some of them considered insane, finally settled on a basin in the foothills of the Yalabali Mountains, near Red Bluff, which had a stream running through it and a couple of small pre-existing flood control dams. They would run a 20-mile aqueduct up there, up a 1,000-foot slope, and dump the Sacramento surplus flows in. The reservoir, to be called the Glen Complex, would be as large as San Francisco Bay. It would submerge both pre-existing reservoirs and a couple of small towns. There would be some contribution from Stony Creek, but not much. A tremendous amount of energy would be required to pump water uphill. A second off-stream reservoir, smaller, but still a third the size of Shasta Lake, would be created farther south, in the foothills near Mount Diablo. Below there, water was already being pumped 3,000 feet uphill for storage in San Luis Reservoir, another off-stream site, and farther south, it was being lifted to improbable heights by the Edmundston pumps. If it was all built, the California Water Project would require about as much electricity as both units of the $5.4 billion Diablo Canyon nuclear reactor could produce, and Brown didn't want that built. Where, then, would the energy come from? The DWR set loose a bewildering flurry of soft path proposals, geothermal plants, wind machines, solar generating ponds. The meanest of the governor's critics, taking note of his interest in Buddhism, said it was all going to be powered by yaks. Brown was so sympathetic to environmentalists in other ways that a lot of them were hesitant to oppose the plan. The California Sierra Club's leadership first endorsed it, only to be overturned in a referendum taken to the members at large. After all, his director of water resources was Ron Roby, a smart, elfin, fast-talking lawyer who had been instrumental, while on the Water Resources Control Board, in writing Decision 1422, a decree requiring minimum freshwater flows through the state's most important estuary, the Delta. Roby's assistant director was Gerald Merrill, a former staff scientist for the Environmental Defense Fund. Merrill, a gaunt, bearded zoologist, was a great fan of wild rivers, an expert whitewater kayaker. There was even a falls and pool on the Tuolumne River named for him. How could people like Jerry Brown, Ron Roby, and Jerry Merrill propose anything really bad? One answer came from Tom Graff, a lawyer for the Environmental Defense Fund and Merrill's former colleague. The centerpiece of Brown's plan was called the Peripheral Canal, an outsized channel to be constructed around the collapsing delta. The Peripheral Canal had been a top priority of the water interests for 40 years. What Brown wanted to do, to win the environmentalists and Northern California's support, was guarantee minimum releases to the delta from the canal. A big surge of water would be let out every few miles, turning the Brown Canal, in effect, into a giant sprinkler hose. Roby and Merrill argued that their plan would mimic the primordial river inflows and eliminate the crossflows caused by the delta pumps. In so doing, it would help salmon and striped bass spawn and actually improve the fishery. In fact, if one listened to them long enough, the whole $11.6 billion scheme was mainly for the sake of the delta fish. But Graff pointed out that the peripheral canal would remove another couple of million acre-feet of water from the delta and San Francisco Bay, water that normally went through at high flows. Delta outflows had already been reduced from 35 million acre-feet to around 17 million, and the fresh water that still managed to escape the project pumps was needed to wash pollution out of the bay. Besides, the whole bay ecosystem had grown dependent on large seasonal freshwater flows over tens of thousands of years. Who was to say that the bay, having already seen its freshwater outflow decline by 55%, wasn't on the brink of ecological ruin? Besides, what if the legislature, dominated by Southern California and the agricultural lobby, decided to overrule the delta outflow guarantees? And what if it decided to dam the North Coast rivers? With a canal in place, it was, after all, to be 400 feet wide and would be capable of containing most of the Sacramento River, the water could finally be moved. The Glen Reservoir site, curiously, was at the receiving end of the proposed grindstone tunnel, which was to have carried water from Dos Rios Reservoir through the Coast Range. The peripheral canal, according to Graff, was a loaded gun pointed at the North Coast. Brown's answer to that, in 1981, was yet another set of environmental guarantees. When his first canal legislation failed to pass the legislature, he supported a new package known as Senate Bill 200, which included an amendment to the state constitution keeping the North Coast rivers wild and scenic forever, which meant no dams. All of the larger ones had had such designations since 1972, but it was state, not federal protection, and the legislature could annul it at will. Brown's constitutional amendment would have made it impossible to develop the Eel and the other rivers unless the state's voters, by a two-thirds majority, decided at some point to repeal it. Jerry Brown was quite sure his proposal would mollify the environmentalists, but it had a totally different result. Until then, feeling about the peripheral canal, a term that became shorthand for everything else in the plan, had sloughed along traditional lines. Northern Californians were mostly against it, the valley and the South Coast were mostly for it. But his decision to include constitutional protection for the North Coast rivers in SB 200 created a stranger alliance than Brown and the growers. It was, in the minds of some, the oddest alliance since the Hitler-Stalin Pact. All of a sudden, two of the mightiest, wealthiest growers in California, were on the side of Friends of the Earth. The two retrograde growers were the J.G. Boswell Corporation and the Salyer Land Company, which had long dominated affairs at the valley's southern end. Salyer and Boswell were two of the main beneficiaries of the Corps of Engineers' Kings River and